Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Today's program explores a good and bad news scenario. First, the good news. The number of opioid overdose deaths is leveling off in some parts of Pennsylvania. Now the bad. Methamphetamine and cocaine use is on the rise. And on some occasions, it is laced with fentanyl. So what does it mean for trying to get those who are using these drugs into treatment and recovery? It is the topic of our show today. Joining us is Jennifer Smith, Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. Secretary Smith, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Matthew Null. He's the Referral Development Manager with Gadensia Addiction Treatment and Recovery. Mr. Null, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Scott. Good to see you again.
If we have any questions or comments, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Secretary Smith, let's start with opioids. For most of the past half decade, Pennsylvania and really across the nation, we have had what is described as an opioid crisis. I hesitate to use the word crisis because I think it's an overused word, but in this case, it is accurate.
Warranted, yes.
So how would you describe where we are with opioids right now in Pennsylvania?
So I think the news is really good. When we start looking across the counties for the overdose death numbers in 2018, particularly if you look at Western Pennsylvania, there were many counties that had really dramatic declines in overdose deaths. We're talking in the 40 and 50% ranges. So Allegheny County, Washington, Westmoreland, even into Butler, Beaver, Armstrong. So really good numbers in that area, which I think is a testament to a couple of different things. Getting naloxone out into communities and into the hands of individuals who might need to use it, as well as the work we've done around the warm handoff process, which I think we might be talking about a little bit later. I think the jury's still out in terms of Southeast Pennsylvania, though, in the Philadelphia area. I think we're hoping that we see a plateau in those numbers. I know early in calendar year 2018, we had seen a decline over the 2017 numbers, but some of those numbers did start to tick up again later in 2018. So I haven't seen a finalized number in Philly yet, but I do believe that our hope statewide is that we have either plateaued or declined slightly in terms of the total number of overdose deaths.
One of the things that has been unique about this opioid crisis is that it has not just been an urban problem. It has spread throughout the state, rural areas, the most rural areas of the state. All levels of socioeconomic classes that it has touched. That is one of the unique things. Let's talk a little bit about geography, and that does correlate somewhat with where people live. But is there a barometer for you to be able to tell, if you look at a certain part of the state that is seeing a decrease or an increase, to say that's a trend?
Yeah. I mean, I think what's important for us is kind of looking at trend data for that particular county over a period of time.
Rather than the state as an entire.
Yeah. I think that's really important. So let me give you just a quick example of why that's important. So up in Crawford County, they would probably argue that they haven't maybe seen an opioid epidemic in their county. And that's because the drugs of choice in Crawford County have continued to be alcohol and methamphetamine. So even though they've seen a rise in opioid use disorder, it wouldn't be what they would constitute necessarily as an epidemic if you were looking specifically at their county. But certainly the usage has increased, which means the capacity for treatment also needs to increase. So it's really important that you kind of keep that in mind when you're looking across the state and not making broad generalizations, but really kind of being very specific about looking county by county at the trends and the data.
And that makes a whole lot of sense, because there are probably a lot of people that think of, when they live in Pennsylvania, that all of Pennsylvania is the same. And I can tell people from traveling around the state, it is not. It's very different. It's a big state. It is very diverse. And you probably, when you see six regions of the state, that it probably can be broken out into much more. So, and plus the other thing we have to think about is, it's not just numbers. These are people that talking about.
That's right.
These are not just numbers. So the big question is, those counties that have seen a decrease in the number of opioid overdose deaths, and I assume overdoses in particular. Mm-hmm. Why?
So as I mentioned before, I think getting Narcan or naloxone out into the hands of the community members and first responders has really been successful in reducing the number of deaths in particular. I think an increased public awareness about heroin and other substances being laced with fentanyl has been helpful for users being a little bit more proactive and cautious about the substances that they're using. I think expanding our warm handoff efforts, which is the activity of getting overdose survivors from the emergency department into some kind of treatment program, has been very successful. So we're not seeing repeat offenders at the emergency department. You know, we used to hear complaints of hospitals seeing the same individual 3-4 times a week, perhaps. And we're seeing those numbers declining because the first time they're there, we're accessing services for them and getting them connected to appropriate resources. So I think it's really been a combination of a lot of different things. I also think public awareness has been very helpful in destigmatizing the disease. We've got a long way to go still, but it has been one benefit, I guess, if you could call it that, of the epidemic, has been some change in that stigma and some acceptance in communities about the need to have services for treatment and for recovery supports and sustained recovery.
Last year, Governor Wolf declared an emergency for this crisis. Has it had an impact?
Absolutely. So we still continue to operate under a disaster declaration every 90 days. We have been renewing that declaration. What it's enabled us to do is bring together up to about 17 different state agencies that meet on a weekly basis every Monday morning at the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency headquarters in Harrisburg. And we have a focused conversation just about the opioid crisis. And so it brings together law enforcement, criminal justice, military affairs, all the health and human service agencies, insurance, aging, to really have a devoted conversation about how every agency can help contribute to this cause. And it sounds like something really simple, but in state government, we don't often have that dedicated effort of so many different agencies trying to determine how they can contribute to solve one cause.
So that wouldn't happen if there wasn't a disaster declaration or emergency declaration?
Yeah, we wouldn't have that kind of lasered focus on an issue with so many agencies involved without that disaster declaration.
Just for context and background purposes, because, you know, I can't assume that everyone knows exactly what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But fentanyl, this has been the scourge here over the last year or so, laced with heroin. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to be talking about it being laced with other drugs as well. But what is fentanyl and why is it so dangerous?
So fentanyl is a substance that is many times more powerful than morphine. So just a very, very small...
It is a painkiller.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. A very, very small amount of fentanyl can be deadly. So what's dangerous here is that it doesn't necessarily look or smell different from heroin. So if you receive a batch of heroin, you wouldn't know unless you actually test it whether or not there's any fentanyl contained in that substance. And so the reason that many overdoses have risen and overdose deaths have risen is because the heroin is being laced with, in some cases, large amounts of fentanyl. And so what will happen is the user utilizes the substance and there's enough fentanyl in that substance to cause an overdose. And sometimes there's so much fentanyl in the substance that even the use of naloxone or Narcan is not successful.
100 times stronger than heroin?
Mm-hmm.
That's the figure
correct.
I've heard?
Yes, that's
so
correct.
If we're talking about the same amount of fentanyl and the same amount of heroin, that the fentanyl would be 100 times more powerful.
That's correct.
And I assume that's the reason that someone would actually want fentanyl is because the high would be much more, I don't know, if exhilarating, or they would get much more of a high out
yes.
of it.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. That's correct.
So, Matthew Noll, at Cadenzia, you see so many of these numbers that we've talked about, but in the form of human beings
right.
and the pain that is caused and families disrupted and all those things. So when we're talking about the opioid crisis, which we have talked about many times with Cadenzia, you get to see it on a daily basis. What are you seeing strictly about opioids right now and people getting into treatment and recovery?
This is still definitely a big problem. You know, our doors are open. We are seeing people, you know, getting into treatment. Just as the secretary stated, we have a lot of those things in place to help get people into treatment, like the warm handoff programs, and they are working. And that's a big help for getting people who are seeking treatment. It is rough because we are working with that individual person, and we see how difficult this disease has, you know, taken over their life and their family life. And we want to focus on that entire family, not just getting the person help, but taking a look at their family and helping them as well, which is an important resource. But right now we are seeing that switch over, as you stated, and I think we'll be talking about, you know, to the cocaine and the meth. But you know, we're happy to see all these upfront, these frontline, you know, efforts. We have amazing people doing awesome work on the front lines. You know, the people that are first responders, to CRS, certified recovery specialists who are out there working, getting people into treatment. If any of those are listening, we thank you because you guys are doing great, great work. And it's so important, you know, to our staff who are there in the trenches every day, you know, helping change these lives. So those front lines efforts, I think, are very strong. They're working, and we're able to get people into treatment. And a lot of those barriers of, well, I can't find a bed and things like that, we're not seeing those problems, you know, like we did in the beginning of all this.
Why?
I think there's you know, we reached out, we saw the need, you know, and so there's more resources that are out there. This is a very important thing, and you know, so we and that's why we always try to stay ahead a little bit, like what's coming up next, you know, and everything. So, you know, with the help from the state, you know, and other organizations, you know, having those resources available has made a big impact. A
couple questions. You said that the family also has to be part of this.
Yes.
Talk about that. Why is that important?
That's probably one of the most key things. If we have a loved one who is having a problem with substance abuse disorder, we want to get them into treatment. But unless the environment around them and the support group changes, that person is going to have difficulty changing as well. And sometimes families, they feel a lot of shame and guilt and anger. They're very, very mad, you know. We want to make sure that if that loved one comes back to the family's prepared and they know what to do, you know, and signs and symptoms and what to look out for, and education on just what is addiction, because they're frustrated and they're upset. It's a family disease, and we need to get that entire family, you know, healthy. So, and sometimes I'll be working with a family and they'll say, oh, you know, well, we're not going to tell the grandparents, you know, and we have a saying, secrets keep you sick. It's important that entire family is educated on, you know, what is, you know, addiction and how it affects the family. And, you know, because if let's say the grandparents are left out, you know, well, that person might be going to them for some money and you know, oh, yeah, we're going to help you out and here's some money, not knowing that they're actually enabling that person. So it's super important that that family gets into Al-Anon meetings and other resources, family counseling, family coaching. There's a lot of different options out there for the family. But that's key, because unless we get that in family, you know, the education is, and it's also very hereditary. This is a big part of our DNA. And so as
you say, talk about that, if you would. I mean, we know that there are still people who would deny that this addiction is a disease.
Right.
But when you say it's hereditary, in what way? I mean, is it environmental that you see mom or dad used alcohol or used drugs? So, oh, I you know, I'm used to it, that's something that our family does. Or biologically, in the DNA, is it a genetic thing?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
The environment, that plays a key role. When, you know, seeing what your parents are doing, the norm of it, you know, oh, my dad smokes marijuana, so I'm, you know, it must be okay. So there is that factor. But our DNA plays a key component in all this. Celiac disease is a disease where you can't process gluten, right? And so all of us have the same digestive system, but why can't one person eat bread and flour and gluten, and I can? Well, that's based on how their body breaks down those chemicals, and that's based on your DNA. Same exact thing with alcohol and drugs. Our bodies, some people will process them differently than the next person. An alcoholic, when they break down alcohol into their body, it actually makes an acetate, and that acetate is almost similar to heroin. So I might have three beers and it makes me sleepy, and you know, I lay on the couch and I go to sleep. Whereas the next person, they get a whole different feeling from that, you know, as well. And we can actually do DNA testing now and to see what drugs, both good and bad drugs, your body can metabolize. And this is a major breakthrough in science, and it's really interesting things. So and that's an important factor to understand, because I can't control my DNA. This is not a choice. This is how my body processes those chemicals, and hopefully to reduce some of that stigma, you know, that goes along with this. And we hear that stigma all the time of, well, this is just a bad person making bad choices. But when we actually look at their biology and what's going on, how their body will metabolize those substances, as well as that brain change that's going on, it's not a choice after that first drink or that first use of drug.
So much more to talk about. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Check out upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. You can see some of the shows that we're working on, such as meeting WITF's new president and CEO. PBS's new NewsHour anchor Judy Woodruff will be with us tomorrow. And coming up next week, an FBI expert on art theft. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. But today, we're talking about, a number of different things. The opioid crisis that we actually are seeing maybe some light at the end of the tunnel, at least in some areas of Pennsylvania. But there is some bad news to go along with it, an increase in some other drugs. Joining us is Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs, Jennifer Smith. Matthew Knoll is Referral Development Manager with Gaudenzi Addiction Treatment and Recovery. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I want to get back, and both of you can join in this part of the conversation. But, a couple of the hurdles that we faced in the past, and I'm sure that they still are there for some people, but education and awareness goes a long way toward stigma. That's one thing, because as we know, there is a stigma. Oh, that person is someone who abuses or is addicted to heroin or another drug. There's that stigma. But also being able to afford treatment. Matthew, you talked about the availability of beds, and you said that things are looking up in that area. But I'm sure there are a lot of people who maybe want to get treatment, but they're afraid they can't afford it. They don't have insurance, or they're thinking this is going to break us. We just will not have the money for this. So let's talk about those two things individually. First of all, stigma. Does education and awareness help to reduce the stigma surrounding this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll chime in quickly, and then I'll let Matt talk, because I actually think he is probably more of the expert in this area than I am. So particularly related to opioid use disorder, since that's the topic of today's conversation, I think one of the areas of stigma that as the state we've tried to hammer away at is the idea of medication-assisted treatment and the role that it plays for treating individuals with opioid use disorder. Excuse me. So when you talk about addiction in general and substance use disorder, the use of medication to treat those disorders is not always appropriate. It really depends on the substance. But in this case, related to opioid use disorder, there are three FDA-approved medications that can be used, and I'm being very careful about that term, can be used to assist with treatment. And this was an idea that not just in Pennsylvania, but nationally had not been well accepted for many, many years. You would often hear the argument, well, you're just replacing one drug for another. So we've done a lot of work around this area trying to educate people that because addiction is a disease, these are medications used to help treat a disease. It's not a drug. It's not an illegal drug. It's a drug that is being prescribed by a physician or administered by an individual who is approved to do so. And it's used in conjunction with behavioral therapies and wraparound services. So it's really important that you understand it's not just the medication that's going to make somebody better. It's the medication that's assisting with the treatment to help them to be able to better utilize those other services, the behavioral services, the wraparound services. So from our perspective, there's just been a lot of work around educating people about the use of medication-assisted treatment as a potential option for individuals, while remembering that it's not the right choice for everybody. And so there's a balance between maintaining accessibility to medication-assisted treatment as well as our standard detox and inpatient programs, which have a really important role to play as well. So from a stigma perspective, we've done a lot around medication-assisted treatment in particular, as well as partnering with the Independence Blue Cross Foundation and Penn State University to develop a website called Someone You Know. And it's where individuals who are in recovery can share their stories about how they got where they are today and the successes that they've been able to accomplish living a life of recovery. And so we've done some community conversations, sharing those stories and talking with communities about what's driving the stigma in your community and how can we as a government entity try to chip away at that. But I think Matt probably has some more kind of boots on the ground input about stigma here in Pennsylvania.
All right. Thank you. In battling this epidemic, you know, we look at barriers. And that was a big thing is where are the barriers and how can we break them down? Is it the number of beds, getting people into treatment, you know, education? I think the largest barrier that prevents people from getting into treatment is our own society and that stigma. You know, if your next door neighbor you find out has cancer, how fast would you take a lasagna over there? You know, hey, is there anything that I can do? If you found out that your next door neighbor has a loved one who's abusing heroin, would you do the same thing? Probably not. You know, so these efforts, you know, that we have on reducing stigma, understanding the background of addiction and that it is a disease and it's not necessarily bad people, right? It's not at all, has helped reduce that. But we still have a long road ahead of us. And I think in the end and who can be and is the heroes of all this, and we need heroes and we need hope right now. That's our recovery community. Mm-hmm. And we need you. So if you're listening right now and you're in the recovery community, please stand up. Let us see you. We need to hear you in the hundreds, in the thousands, in the millions. You know, we have September's Recovery Month. Come out, please, because we need to show society that this is all walks of life. Recovery does happen. People can get in treatment. And, you know, if you're listening out there and you are struggling, you don't have to feel this way anymore. You know, there's a new life to live and there's a better life to live. And we need those people that are living that life of recovery. If it's a day, if it's a year, if it's 10 years, let us see you. Let us hear you. Because ultimately, that family who maybe once shunned you now needs you. And that's who we can turn to. And we need to hear your stories of what worked for you because everybody's a little bit different. There's no single bullet that's going to fix any of this. And everyone is individualized, and we need to hear, and we need you.
A couple of things. Is it accurate to say that almost every family in this country knows someone, has been touched by someone who has, you know, has this problem?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Whether they know it or not.
That's right.
Okay. Now, what you had just said about bad people, that these aren't bad people, and I'm not disagreeing with you and obviously don't want to encourage more stigma out there.
Right.
But at the same time, there would be people who would say, yes, this may not be a bad person, but their addiction may make them do bad things.
That is correct.
Plus, they also may deal with bad people who are selling the drug to them or supplying the drug to
Absolutely.
Them. So that may be one of the things that people are afraid of reaching out because of that element, those elements of it.
I agree. Yes. And that's where we take a look at a lot of different issues that are going on with, you know, crime and abuse and some of these bad actions to help reduce those. We need to get to the underlying core. and that underlying core might be addiction. You know, we have like all the different court systems and family wellness courts where they understand that there might be a problem that are affecting the children, but they now recognize that that might be addiction based. So let's get that parent into treatment. Let's get that parent some help, because we know that's going to help those secondary things that are occurring because of that. And I'm really glad to see that trend and understanding that let's get down to the core of what's going on. But then what we have to actually do is get down to the core of why is that person turning to drugs and alcohol in the first place? And that's what we do in treatment, is we peel off those layers and understand what's going on in that person's life. Why, you know, a lot of people think, well, they're just using drugs to party and have fun. And sure, that might be their entrance into it. And that does happen. But it will then turn into a second phase where they're using those drugs to escape those feelings or escape the bad things going on in their lives and to cover up emotions, not necessarily using them to experience new feelings, but to hide from feelings. And that's what we need to do, is peel off those layers of what's going on. You know, was there something in the past? Is there something now? Or lots of times, in my act of addiction, I was doing things that are very shameful and hurtful. And the shame and guilt on someone in active addiction is very strong. They're not going to admit that, but it's there. And so now they were prostituting. They pawned off mom's engagement ring. They've done all these really bad things, and they hate that feeling. What takes them away from that feeling? Use more drugs. But what we have to do is, through counseling and treatment, is help them deal with those underlying things to truly get that person to accept themselves and to love themselves again.
Secretary Smith, I mentioned stigma being one of the hurdles. The other, for many people, has been money. We know that there have been changes here in the last few years, but is it still an issue for many people to get into recovery?
Unfortunately, I think people do perceive that continually as an issue. And I think what's important to get the word out about is the fact that it should never be a barrier to treatment. So there's a number of funding sources coming in through our department that ultimately get filtered down to the county level that can be utilized for individuals who either have no insurance or are a group that we called underinsured, which really means that they may have another form of insurance. They may have private insurance, but their copays and deductibles are so high, and so it would preclude them from receiving treatment. We can use our dollars to pay for those types of things. So there should be no financial reason why anyone doesn't seek treatment. And that's a really important message to get out there. So if you fall in that category, or you have a loved one that you've been loaning money to try to help them get treatment, please know that the dollars are out there. You need to seek out your single county authority. So if you go on our website, the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs website, you can search for your single county authority. There will be a number for you to contact, or a, you know, email for you to contact, and you can very easily have a conversation about how you can get those costs covered. There's a lot of money flowing into the drug and alcohol system right now, not just in Pennsylvania, but nationally. And that really is thanks to a bipartisan effort nationwide to make sure that we're dealing with this crisis appropriately. So there's funding available. Please, please, please don't let financial reasons be the challenge for you seeking treatment.
I always think it's good to point out that one of the real changes that has occurred, if I could call it an issue, with this issue over the last few years, is that it is no longer looked at as a law enforcement or law and order issue. It is now looked at as, for the most part, as a medical issue, a health issue, and that it really doesn't matter where you are politically, that you know, you have people, and you said it's a bipartisan effort. You have Republicans, you have Democrats, you have conservatives, you have liberals who will say that there's a problem. And rather than fighting about it, we've got to find a way to fight this. And, you know, at a time when there was a lot of disagreement in Washington, sometimes in Harrisburg, it's good to see that people have kind of gathered around this and said, we've got to do something and we've got to make it work, find a solution.
Yeah, I saw an interesting quote. I think it was from someone from Washington County, and it was in an article I read recently that said, you know, it's not about a war on drugs anymore. It's about a war on addiction. And I thought that was stated very well. It's not about law enforcement. It's not about just cracking down on dealers. It's really about trying to address addiction as a disease while still keeping a focus on, you know, where is the supply coming in and how do we reduce that supply, but really turning more of our focus to the treatment of the disease.
Up until now in our conversation, we have focused mostly on the opioid crisis, and there does seem to be some reason for optimism. But let's turn our attention now. I guess in circles where people pay attention to this issue all the time, it wasn't a surprise. Those like you, Matthew, who work with this all the time, wasn't a surprise. But I got the sense, Secretary Smith, when you had your budget hearing a couple weeks ago, that it surprised some people to hear that methamphetamine and cocaine in particular were making comebacks. What's happening with those two drugs in particular? And are there other drugs that we're starting to see an increase in usage?
Yeah, so I think it was surprising to some people that we're seeing it in Pennsylvania. I have been hearing about this trend nationally for the last 2 to 3 years. So some of my counterparts out in the Midwest states in particular have started to see this resurgence of cocaine and methamphetamine for quite some time. In fact, when the federal funding started to come out related to the opioid crisis, some of those states actually said, I don't know that we can use this because we don't have an opioid crisis right now. We have a methamphetamine crisis. And the dollars were specific to opioids. So that benefited some of us states who are experiencing an opioid crisis because we were able to absorb some of those dollars. So we've been hearing nationally for quite some time that there's starting to be this downturn in opioids, but an uptick in cocaine and methamphetamine. I don't think, though, here in Pennsylvania, it was until recently that we really started seeing that come to fruition. So in 2017, there's some good information out from the DEA in terms of seizures around cocaine and methamphetamine, and those were on the rise in 2017. But that's just related to seizures. What we're seeing from a treatment perspective, from an overdose perspective, I think we've only just started to see the surgence of those particular substances. And unfortunately, they're mixed with fentanyl as well.
But that was my next question. When we are seeing the overdoses, are we seeing overdoses of just those drugs being used, or are they laced with fentanyl?
It's quite often a mixture of many substances, unfortunately. And you had asked a question, which I didn't answer just a moment ago, which was, where are we seeing this? In Pennsylvania, predominantly, we're seeing the uptick in Philadelphia, in Pittsburgh, out in Allegheny County, and then some in the Johnstown area in Cambria County. And we suspect that Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, Williamsport will probably be soon to follow. And I know that Matt and I were talking before the show started about whether or not he's been seeing this, and he confirmed what I've been hearing from a state level. So maybe Matt wants to talk a little bit about it.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yes, when we take a look at, you know, the clients that are turning to us, you know, to get into treatment, we definitely see an increase in meth and in coke. And I had the opportunity to sit down with some of our clients because we want to stay up on the trends and to sit down with them and say, what's going on, you know, and what's going on the streets, what's kind of like the vibe and everything. I guess a good way to put it is perceived risk. When perceived risk of a drug goes up, usage goes down. When perceived risk of a drug goes down, usage goes up. And so the perceived risk of heroin is very high. People understand that. And sitting down with some of our clients, some of them switched over. They were using heroin and made that switch. And it might have been for numerous reasons, but you know, it was common where my girlfriend overdosed and passed away from heroin. So I made that switch, or other people they knew and they see the overdoses, to someone who was progressing in their addiction and got to that fork in the road of, okay, what do I do next? And I had the opportunity to go to heroin, but no, I know the risk of that, so we went with the meth. There's still a lot of concern of not knowing what you're getting. And all of them, everyone that I talked to was definitely had anxiety every time they got it because they weren't sure, is there going to be fentanyl, you know, mixed in with it as well. So that was a big underlying, you know, component of it as well. So it's interesting to see. By no means are we seeing a drastic, heroin's still there. It's still an issue. And It's not time to start giving high fives and saying, yay, you know, we beat the opioid epidemic. And that's a big concern of us. And this was a predictable change. We knew this was going to happen because of the perceived risk. However, we still need the support. We still need the funding. We are not out of the dark by any means. We're still seeing a large number of people coming in, you know, that are addicted to heroin. But it's important to stay ahead of the game, too, so we can be prepared. And as we are seeing the switch, you know, why switching also? Meth is cheaper. The high lasts much longer. It takes away some of the withdrawal symptoms from heroin, you know, as well. Availability, that's always a big concern, is which one, you know, is it easier to get, you know, my hands on and everything. So there's a bunch of different things that are all components of this, and it's important that we keep an eye on it so we can be prepared to have those resources that are needed.
I was thinking, as you were talking about making the switch, I mean, this isn't like going from Coke to Pepsi. If someone is addicted to heroin and they do make that switch to methamphetamines or cocaine, they're still addicted to heroin, right?
Yes. And back to that DNA, there's some drugs that I'm going to like. There's some drugs that I'm not going to like based on, you know, how my body processes those things. And we say people will have a drug of choice. And other people, they just want something, anything. So there's a wide range of why someone would be making that switch based on what their own personal preference are. But ultimately, going back to those escape feelings, what I don't like the most is all those feelings, emotions, my anxiety, my depression. And that's one thing that we are seeing an uptick in, is the mental health component in all of this. And that's a big concern. And we, you know, making sure that we have the mental health dual diagnosis, co-occurring programs and resources there, because mental health and drug and alcohol is the same thing, you know, and we need to, when taking a look at the bigger picture of things and how to truly help people, we need to have that mental health component, you know, just as strong. I can get the person into an environment where there's no drugs and alcohol. That's the easy part. The more difficult part is understanding what's going on with them and getting them help that they need, you know, in any mental health concerns.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to meet WITF's brand new CEO and president. Also going to be speaking with PBS NewsHour anchor Judy Woodruff coming up tomorrow. And also a litter reduction program in the Poconos that may go statewide. That's all coming up on tomorrow's show. So be sure to tune in. Our guest today, Jennifer Smith, Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. Matthew Null, Referral Development Manager with Gaudenzia Addiction Treatment and Recovery. If you have a question or comment, we have a few minutes left. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, I'm curious about this. We've been talking a lot about fentanyl. And, you know, I had asked earlier about, you know, the power of how much more powerful it is, heroin, and the feelings that it does, the high that it does give those who use it. I mean, are there those, I mean, obviously, there are a lot of people who know the dangers of fentanyl. Do they ask, does that person who uses ask when they're purchasing the drug, oh, by the way, is there fentanyl in this?
They might. However, we don't know. They're not going to know. Their dealer's not necessarily going to know. That drug has passed through numerous people's hands, and the bottom line is the dollar, right? And so that dealer might not have cut it or laced it with fentanyl, but maybe the person they got it from has, you know, and it might have done that multiple times, and so now maybe, oh, I'll only put a little in, right, and cut it. But then that's done with the next person over. Now we have a large amount in there. So the unknown, and when I was speaking to the clients, no matter what drug of choice they were using, there is still that fear of what's truly in this. Is this safe? And some of them talked about a strong rapport with their dealer, in that, you know, they did trust them and they only would buy from a certain person, to that desperate phase where I just need anything right now. And that's where they're really, you know, putting their life at harm's way. No matter any time, you know, that next time you put that needle in your arm, it could be that last. You have no idea what's in there. And that's the true danger of all this.
Secretary Smith, where's fentanyl coming from?
Well, I mean, certainly there was a lot of talk recently about it coming from China. And so we were trying to work with them to try to see fewer shipments of that coming from China. I don't know that that was really as successful as we hoped it would be. From Pennsylvania's perspective, though, unfortunately for us, we kind of are situated geographically along two kind of major drug trafficking routes. So a route that comes from Detroit and swings down around through Pittsburgh and across to Philadelphia, and then the route that runs from New York City down to Miami in Florida, which passes through Philadelphia also. So that's where we're seeing a lot of things coming in on those routes, and that's why we've seen a large number of overdose deaths in particularly Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, because they fall on either one or both of those two major trafficking routes.
You know, I received an email from someone a while back when we talked about the fentanyl, and this person said that they are in pain constantly. And since fentanyl has been demonized, talked about only in the context of being abused or, you know, being laced with heroin or other drugs, that this person said, I can't get my fentanyl and I am in pain constantly. There are uses for it, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. There are appropriate medical uses, not just for fentanyl, but for opioids in general. And so something that Dr. Levine, Secretary for the Department of Health, and I talk about all the time is making sure that we're not swinging the pendulum too far, right? So we got to a place when, you know, at the height of the epidemic where it seemed like doctors were really overprescribing. They didn't understand that this was an addictive drug. They were, you know, giving you 30 pills when maybe you only needed 7. So we did a lot around appropriate prescribing. We developed prescribing guidelines. We did prescriber education on this topic. We implemented a prescription drug monitoring program to ensure that we're not overprescribing. But what we have to be really, really careful about is that we're not completely cutting off the supply of opioids, because there truly are medical instances where an opioid is absolutely the right drug to treat those things. So it's important that we kind of keep an eye on the medical community and make sure that they have the tools they need to understand what is appropriate prescribing, and that they're not getting this perception that you should never prescribe it. And we certainly have heard complaints from patients who have contacted one or both of our offices saying, hey, I can't get my medication here. And so we've done some individualized outreach to those particular providers to educate them about, you know, medical necessity for some of these opioids. So it's really that delicate balance of making sure that the pendulum isn't swinging too far in either direction, and that people who really need the medications can still have access to them.
Wanted to define something that we've talked about often during the program, warm handoff, just for those who are not familiar with that term. What is a warm handoff?
So when we talk about warm handoffs, we're talking about a facilitated referral to treatment for individuals who are at the emergency department and have survived an overdose. So if you overdose on a scene, the EMS transport you to the hospital. When you're in the hospital and you are now stabilized, we will conduct what we call a warm handoff process. And that's where we have an individual come speak with you about the opportunities that you have for treatment. And that could be opportunities to start medication-assisted treatment right there in the emergency department with a connection to some outpatient behavioral therapy services. Or it could mean a connection into a detox facility. It could mean a connection to other types of recovery supports. So we utilize, in many cases, what we call certified recovery specialists to do that work. And that's an individual with lived addiction experience, so someone who is in recovery themselves. And we find that model to be extremely successful. So those certified recovery specialists will go into the emergency department with the individual who has survived the overdose, have these conversations conversations, work with them, say, I was where you are. Look what can happen. You can have a successful job and a car and a place to live, and life can be really good for you. And here's how I can help you get that for yourself. And then the certified recovery specialist will make all the appropriate connections, which could be to a facility like Matt's, for example, to make sure that they're properly assessed and then intaked into a program that's appropriate for them clinically.
We had an email here from a listener who says, just want to affirm that this does affect families. She said she had a son who died of addiction. He was young and promising, who experimented with drugs and got hooked. She thanks us for bringing the topic to the airwaves. Cynthia, our hearts go out to you and our sympathies. But, you know, those kind of testimonials, I think, do have an impact on other people and other families that
Absolutely.
Get to hear that as well. I mentioned that I received this email about fentanyl. I receive emails all the time when we do these programs. Another email I received, and I've heard this from other people as well, is that, you know, so often during the opioid crisis, we've talked about nothing but opioids. And I was reminded, didn't need to really be reminded, but reminded to bring it to the audience's attention, is that alcohol is still the drug of choice, if you will.
Yeah.
And Matthew, you've seen that? You continue to see that?
Yeah, I'm a prevention guy, and I have a big prevention background. But in the prevention world, we have 16 principles of prevention, and this is kind of like our guidelines of what we want to follow and what works and what doesn't work. But one of those is very important: of never be a single drug focused, and that's always a concern of mine because, Mom, yeah, it's only some weed. At least I'm not doing heroin. Or Dad, you know, it's only meth. At least I'm not doing heroin. And sometimes, well, you know, we put a focus all on the heroin, and a drug is a drug is a drug, and they can all destroy your life just as powerful. Yes, we need to focus on reducing the deaths. There's no doubt about that. But you know, there's a lot of other drugs. There's a lot, and that's why I guess what we want to focus on is we have a drug epidemic right now, not just a heroin epidemic. And as we are seeing a changeover and a reduction in the deaths, we don't want to perceive that we have fewer people doing drugs and we don't need the resources and the fundings. And that's an important thing that we want to keep in mind here is, you know, and using those prevention, you know, methods and things, you know, to reduce the overall drug use. But you're absolutely right. You know, alcohol is a powerful drug, and it destroys lives. We see that's in our top three of why people are coming into treatment is alcohol. Availability, obviously. Also, just that socialized, you know, component of it, you know, and seeing, and it definitely very hereditary, you know, running in the family. So alcohol definitely needs to be on our radar, and there's help out there for that. And it's also dangerous. You know, an alcoholic just stopping, they can potentially die. So it's really important that an alcoholic gets into treatment, gets the medical care that they need.
You have mentioned to me that marijuana is actually in those top three. And I was a little surprised that people are being treated for marijuana, especially at a time when it's becoming more widespread across the country. And even here in Pennsylvania, we're talking about right. legalizing marijuana for recreational purposes. People are being treated for marijuana addiction? Is that the way to – I mean, it's not biologically or physically, I would assume, addictive, but – talk about that if you would.
Again,
I got about a minute left.
Okay, perceived risk. Perceived risk of heroin, extremely high. Use kind of going down. Perceived risk of marijuana right now, zilch, right? Very, very low, and we see a lot of use. The marijuana today is much different than the marijuana 10 years ago. It's extremely strong. We are seeing behaviors while someone is under the influence of marijuana being very, very extreme, much different than in the past because of the levels of THC. Talking to some state police officers last night, 70% of all DUIs are mostly marijuana.
70% now.
Right, you know, and 30% being alcohol. So driving while under the influence. And also, when it comes to someone's, you know, addiction with that, you know, talking with people and even knowing some friends, they can't go to work without smoking up first. You know, they can't get out of bed without smoking up first. So the addiction can wear many faces, you know, and be perceived in many different ways. But there are people that are definitely addicted and they need that marijuana, and it's destroying their life just as any other drug can.
Secretary Jennifer Smith and Matthew Noah of Gaudenzia, thank you very much for being with us today. A lot of great information, and I hope that it's something that the audience will take to heart, what we've had to say today. But thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we do meet WITF's new CEO and president, talk with Judy Woodruff of PBS's NewsHour as well. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Have a good day. I'm Scott Lamar.